Hello, I'm Jane Crowell, the editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. And today I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
Hello, and our editor-at-large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
Hello. Now, Jamie, Jordan's made an effort with his name on his Zoom as Duke Jordo Atreides. What are you going for?
I've made a big effort and I've gone for Jamie Graham.
I have made a big effort and gone for my own name as well. I think Jordan keeps doing this and he's upping the game and the rest of us are just falling behind. But anyway.
Yeah, but also Jordan's got more technical knowledge than us. I mean,
This is true.
Actually would not have a clue how to change my name on Zoom, even if I wanted to. So there you go.
This is true. If ever I don't know what to do with something on my phone, I ask Jordan. Anyway, this week, the name change for him with a House of Atreides name is because we are talking about the long-awaited sci-fi epic, Dune. We're also looking at Wes Anderson's latest, The French Dispatch, musical Dear Evan Hansen, and animation CryptoZoo. But before we get to those, what have you guys been watching apart from those this week?
I've been headlong diving back into the 1970s. I just suddenly decided, I always do these little seasons of films for myself where I suddenly go, right, I'm going to watch every Robert Altman film or Brian De Palma film or whatever, just to keep the existential angst at bay. And basically, I've gone back into the 1970s. So I watched the first two Godfather movies. And then I watched the third one, 1990, just to complete the trilogy. I watched Apocalypse Now, Five Easy Pieces, Chinatown, Nashville. So I've just been redoing some of the absolute kind of classics of that decade, the American sort of cornerstones of American cinema, and having an absolute ball doing it. I mean, I don't know if anyone else gets like this, but every now and then I go on a run of bad films. You know, I obviously watch a lot of films coming out now, and there's a lot of great films coming out now, but every now and then you get a run of bad ones. So if you do something like this, it just reminds me how great cinema can be and sort of keeps the passion alive.
Okay. Well, have you been keeping the passion alive, Jordan?
Yeah, not with the 70s, but I did go back to the 80s, sort of, because I went to see the Back to the Future musical.
Oh, yeah.
That's currently playing in London. That was a lot of fun. It's a very interesting take on it, because obviously they've added a ton of songs to it. Alan Silvestri was part of it. Some of the songs are great, some of them not so great, but there's a lot of fun stuff with the DeLorean. I wasn't sure what they were going to be able to do with the car, because it's all set on a single stage, but they do some very exciting, interesting things with it. I don't want to spoil it if people want to go and see it themselves.
Totally booking a ticket for that. I love a bit of a theatre experience, and it sounds really good.
Yeah, it's well worth a ticket, I would say. Really good fun.
Cool.
What have you been watching, Jay?
Well, I revisited for my birthday Smokey and the Bandit because it's been a very long time since I've seen it. And I had a bit of a boozy lunch and I sat down to watch it. And I was pleasantly surprised that although there are some iffy moments, it actually still stands up. And I just love Burt Reynolds in that, like with his cowboy hat on and his red shirt and eye-wateringly tight jeans, and Sally Field, that great chemistry they have, that Trans Am just burning up Georgia, the dog in the truck, the terrible sheriff, Buford T. Justice on their trail, and that really catchy theme tune. I flipping loved it, and I sort of wondered why nobody's decided to remake that with, like The Rock in a supercar or something. You know, like it sort of feels a bit like it might be ripe for the remaking, which I'm glad they haven't, I must say.
Yeah,
really good, loved it, and have been singing Eastbound and Down, Packaged Up and Trucking, or whatever it is. The little theme from is going around my head ever since. So that was what I was doing. But also, obviously, LFF finished, so I've crawled to the end of LFF, having had a lot of screenings for that. So ended on the tragedy of Macbeth with Frances McDormand and Denzel Washington, which was very beautiful to look at. So yeah, shall we get on to what we can watch this week and what we can feast our eyes upon on the big screen? It's time to go in search of spice. It's this.
You inherit too much power. You have proven you can rule yourself. Now you must learn to rule others. Something none of your ancestors learned.
My father rules an entire planet.
He's losing it.
He's getting a richer one.
He'll lose that one too.
So this is Dune, which you've waited for forever. It feels a bit like when Bond came out. Jordan, for those that don't know what this is about, set it up for us.
Yeah, so this is an adaptation of Frank Herbert's 1965 novel, widely considered one of the most influential, if not one of the best science fiction novels ever written, previously adapted by David Lynch in 1984, of course, a very controversial, not particularly well-regarded adaptation, though it does have a cult following. This new version is directed by Denis Villeneuve, of Arrival and Blade Runner 2049 most recently. He is an expert at world building, and he is also a huge Dune fan. He read
total nerd, right?
Yep.
You read it when he nerded out, didn't you, when you were talking to him about it?
We did, yeah. I got the pleasure of speaking to him for our cover feature a few months back, and it was, yeah, nerd heaven, I would say. He read it even younger than I did. I read it when I was about 15, 16. He read it when he was 13 or 14 years old, instantly became obsessed with it, created what he described as storyboards for a kind of film version. This was when he was still a teenager with one of his best friends. So he's basically had this film adaptation in his head for almost 40 years at this point. Which is crazy. And I think that kind of long build-up shows in the film because it's an extraordinarily beautiful film. So for those who don't know the story, it's set in the very, very distant future of humanity. It's the year sort of 10,000. Humanity has kind of colonized the stars at this point. And on the planet of Caladan, which is where the House Atreides live, you have Paul Atreides, played here by Timothy Chalamet, his father, Duke Leto Atreides, played by Oscar Isaac, and his mother, the Lady Jessica, played by Rebecca Ferguson. At the start of the film, we learn that House Atreides has been given a kind of fiefdom over the planet of Arrakis, which is a desert planet, a bit like Tatooine. But what makes this desert planet special is that it is the galaxy's sort of sole resource of the spice melange, which is a powerful sort of hallucinogenic, which is also vital to interstellar travel. It's a MacGuffin, but it's basically the most desired resource in the universe.
A bit like petrol at the moment.
Exactly, yeah. it's even harder to get hold of than petrol, believe it or not. The Atreides are going to replace the outgoing House Harkonnen, who are basically just mega evil bastards. They're led by Baron Harkonnen, led by Stellan Skarsgård. You've also got Dave Bautista, who's part of that house as well, who is the Beast Raban Harkonnen. They're none too pleased that they're getting kicked off Arrakis because the spice is a very lucrative business for them. But the Atreides, particularly Duke Leto, who is a kind of very wise and noble leader, knows that this is essentially a trap. His house is being set up for failure. So as they arrive on Arrakis, they are searching for spies. They are trying everything that they can not to fall, not to be taken down. It's a kind of mix between Star Wars, Game of Thrones. It's almost a medieval story. It's about warring families. There's a lot of interesting subtext to the film, not even so much subtext, because the spice melange is basically a metaphor for oil and the exploitation of the planet. There's a lot of ecological messages. And in the middle of this, you have Paul, who is this chosen one type figure who...
Christ metaphor.
Yeah, huge Christ metaphor. He is set up to lead this planet to freedom, which is something you don't get to see in this film, because the important thing to point out about Dune Part 1, as it's dubbed, is that it's only the first half of the novel. It's come in for a little bit of criticism for, which I don't entirely disagree with, but I think if you go in expecting not to be told the full story, you won't be too disappointed.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I thought this was just an absolute masterpiece. I thought this was completely wonderful. It's been a long time since we've had a film of kind of this scale, of this kind of ambition. Denis's kind of world building in this is absolutely extraordinary. Production design, costume design is all just exquisite and beautiful. Everything down to, you know, the music, Hans Zimmer's score is just mind-blowing. I love the performances in it. There's some incredible action in it as well. Even though it's a very sort of sincere and played straight film, you do get some real scope, and you do get your money's worth out of this film as well. I just thought it was completely wonderful. I was totally mesmerized. It reminded me of sitting in a cinema and watching like the Lord of the Rings for the first time and just being completely transported to another world. I really haven't had that feeling for, you know, 20 years since those three films came out. And Dune really, really did that for me. As I say, I was a huge fan of the novel growing up and a sort of moderate fan of the David Lynch film. It got some things right, got some things horribly wrong. It has a horribly rushed ending, which is why I think Denis' decision to split this into two films was probably ultimately the right choice. But yeah, I thought this was about as good as an adaptation as you could possibly hope for of that novel.
Well, I was going to say that, Jordan, in terms of you mentioned that some people have complained that it's only half a story and they feel, you know, a bit left up in the air. But what would they rather? Because the book is like a, you know, bloody doorstop. And we all know the David Lynch version, I think it was like 2.25 hours long. And it was still so rushed that, you know, towards the end, like you say, it suddenly has to get about 300, 400 pages into the last 20 minutes of the film. And it's so unsatisfying because of that. And there's other stuff in the Lynch film I really like. But I mean, what would people prefer? I mean, surely they'd prefer to do it on this scale and have it split over two films like Lord of the Rings was split over three films, etc. I mean, so I don't quite get that criticism. I mean, do you?
Not entirely, no. I think he's made the right choice. I think it was a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of situation, really. The only other option is to make a mini-series or something and do it all in one go. But if you do that, you're just not going to have the kind of visuals that you do in this film. Like, this was a $170 million film, not a cheap film to make at all. And, you know, every dollar is on screen. It looks absolutely astonishing. I'd say it's probably one of the best-looking movies I've seen in, like, the last 10 years. It's just absolutely beautiful. So I'm personally delighted that he's done it this way. The one big concern, of course, is that part two hasn't been greenlit and isn't guaranteed.
Yeah, and it doesn't make enough money.
Yeah, so there is a world where this is all we get, and that would be an absolute tragedy. I would be devastated if we don't get to see the conclusion of this story, because there's so much more interesting stuff he can do. There's some incredible things in the second half of this story, as I'm sure people are aware if they've seen the David Lynch version or read the novel. These are all big questions that sort of hang over Dune, but even just based purely on part one, I thought this was just an absolutely unbelievable spectacle. As an adaptation, I thought it was just incredibly smart. He's done some really interesting things here. The novel is very interior. It's full of voiceovers. Each chapter is told from various characters, you know, interior perspectives. You don't get any voiceover here as you did in the David Lynch film. It's all treated like a modern film, quote unquote. It's a really interesting adaptation. I think one of the better things that he's done is he's amplified the female characters in the film. He's given Lady Jessica a much more interesting and central role to the story here. He's gender swapped one of the characters. Dr. Liette Kynes is now played by a woman, Sharon Duncan Brewster. That character is a man in the novel. Doesn't make a huge difference, but I think it's important just to have more female roles in this story, because it is a very male-dominated story in its previous forms. The other thing to note is that this film probably gives Jason Momoa his best role ever. Jason Momoa is so great.
Absolutely does, yeah.
He plays Duncan Idaho, who's kind of this swashbuckling swordsman, like a cross between, like, I don't know, an Errol Flynn-type character in Indiana Jones or something, and Han Solo, like all those kind of archetypes. And I feel like he was just born to play this type of character. He's just so charismatic and cool and funny. He's the one character that gives the film a little bit of levity. There's actually a few jokes that come from this character, because otherwise Dune is a very sort of sincere and straight film. Some people have called it dour. I think that's a bit extreme. I'm just glad that someone is able to get films that aren't full of quips made anymore, to be honest. I don't always want to go to the cinema and watch a film where people are, you know, dropping snark grenades every 5 minutes. Like, I quite like to see people treating subject matter seriously sometimes. And I'm glad that this is the film that they've done it with, because it just suits the story that they're telling totally. Because it is ultimately quite a serious story. Like, they're trying to do, like, important things with it. Like, it's not just a bit of fluff. There are messages and there are metaphors and there's all that kind of meaty stuff in there that you can really latch onto if that's what you're there for. Or alternatively, it's just really exciting and really fun and really transportive.
Talking of being really exciting, you've talked very passionately and eloquently for 15 minutes about this film. In a way, I haven't seen it yet and I'm desperate to see it, and you're making me even more desperate to see it. But you haven't yet mentioned the sandworms.
The sandworms, amazing.
Which we get a glimpse of in the trailer. And of course, anyone who knows the book and the Lynch version would be looking forward to the sandworms. So tell us about them. And does he pull it off having these like 700-foot giant worms?
I think that's one of the most exciting sequences in the whole film, frankly. This moment that, I mean, is very true to the novel. And they go out to look at a spice harvester, the house of Atreides. They land up down there. They're like, yeah, let's have a look at this. And then it's like, oh, wait a minute, a worm's incoming. And there's this horrible sort of thing on the horizon. But they need to get the people off the harvester, and how are they going to do that, because this worm's coming. And it's a sort of 50-minute sequence of pure like gritting teeth tension and amazing visuals, and the music soars, and the, you know, the, you've probably seen a little element of this in the trailer, and it's properly gripping. And that happens quite early on, but that really sets you up for the sort of the danger that lurks. And the worms are very emblematic of the danger that lurks for Paul in his sort of life from a sort of court point of view, and the fact that everybody's out to get him. And we probably should talk about Paul as well, shouldn't we, Jordan? Because Timothy Chalamet is taking on this role, the internet's current boyfriend. So that might be off-putting for some people, like, God, Chalamet is everywhere, he's cast in everything, he's Wonka, he's this, he's that. You know, he's playing Shakespeare, he's doing everything. But he's actually brilliant in this, isn't he? I mean, I think this is just perfect casting for him, because he has that boyishness that people might underestimate, i.e. enemies of Paul, but also that sort of ability to do steel when he needs to. And I don't mean blue steel, although he does do extremely good blue steel looks into the distance when required, with his hair perfectly blowing in the wind, as Jordan mentioned. God, his hair is like an actor in itself. It actually moves in accordance to his emotions. Yeah, if you love Timmy's hair, it's Timmy hair porn, isn't it? But he is excellent in this, right?
Oh, yeah, he's terrific. I was sold on him very, very early. I was a tiny bit skeptical going in, because his character is much younger in the novel than he is. The character's sort of 15, 16 in the novel. Timmy's almost mid-20s now. But I was sold very early. There's a scene early on where Paul is introduced to a Bene Gesserit sister called Gaius Helen Mahayam, played here by Charlotte Rampling. It's an iconic scene in the novel where he is sort of tested on his abilities. I always found the Lynch version of that scene just awful, just embarrassingly cheesy. All due respect to Kyle MacLachlan, but he does not nail that scene at all. But Timothy like really, really nails what makes that scene so like just scary and frightening in the novel. And this is like life or death stakes for him so early on. And from that moment, I was just totally in on Timmy. There's a little bit of warmth in there, but I think what's important about Paul is that he just has the weight of the world on his shoulders, and that's what I thought Timmy sold so well. I really bought him as this character.
Well, I've got to say, I was a massive fan of The King, which I know Jane wasn't as much, but I was a massive fan of The King, the kind of Henry V adaptation in which he plays Hal. And it's a similar trajectory there, that he is crowned King Henry V, you know, and he's so boyish and he has to navigate the politics of court. And obviously he's really naive and young. And during the course of the film, he goes on this journey to become a man and sort of show that inner steel. And I thought he was absolutely brilliant in that film. Like, I think he should have been Oscar nominated for that film. I rate it that highly. So I'm all in on Timmy in this.
I think he does an even better job. I mean, I wasn't convinced with The King. I thought he didn't quite nail it, but I think whatever he learned doing The King, he brings to this and really absolutely nails it. And that journey that you talk about, or from boy to man, is beautifully sort of sketched by him on screen, but with obviously the help of this amazing support cast around him. I mean, who isn't in this film? It's wall-to-wall great actors. And then the other person that we should talk about, and I loved Rebecca Ferguson as well, as you did, Jordan. I think she's a great actress, but also she's just the sort of relationship between Paul and his mother in this is really interesting. And this idea of a mother's role to nurture and protect, but also to allow a child to go out and fulfill their destiny. And how do you do that? How do you protect and also sort of set them on their journey? Was really interesting. But the other person that's really key to this, and it's in it very little because obviously she'll turn up more in part two, is Zendaya. And she's such an electric presence, I find, in any film. And she, again, is the perfect choice for this woman that is in Paul's dreams and then turns up into his reality and is just absolutely mesmerizing. And everything about this film is everything I hate on paper. You know, I tried reading the book. I was like, no, absolutely not. It's just not my thing. And I loved everything about this.
But here is a question maybe to finish on. I mean, will it be a hit? Because it has to be a hit to get this part two made. Mm. It's being released at the time where, you know, Venom 2, Let There Be Carnage, Halloween Kills, Bond is still playing in cinemas. We've seen this week with Ridley Scott's The Last Duel. It's absolutely bombed because it's not getting screen space. You know, there's no room with those big hitters around. Now, Dune will get the screen space, but will it be a hit? As it's up against that competition, it does have a reputation. I think people who don't even consciously know the book have sort of heard of it and think it's real sci-fi, kind of hard sci-fi and nerdy, and would be off-putting. And do they want to go and watch 2.5-3 hours of that? You know, so is it going to get the audiences in? Is it going to make enough money that we get to see part two, which we need to see?
Yeah, and I mean, when you think about Blade Runner 2049, you know, that was a flipping beautiful film, wonderful adaptation of source material and taking that further. Denis Villeneuve, his world building, and that didn't make the money, did it?
No.
So it is worrying.
So it has already opened in a few markets around the world and it's doing, I think, relatively well, but it obviously hasn't opened in, you know, the key markets yet, America, China, the UK, all these places. It's going to be a tough sell. Especially in America, where it's also available to stream day and date on HBO Max.
Don't watch it on a tiny screen.
Which is kind of insane to me, but, you know, that's the situation. That's undoubtedly going to harm the box office. I sincerely hope people do turn up because it's a wonderful film. There's so much we haven't talked about with this film as well. We have barely mentioned the Fremen. We haven't mentioned that Javier Bardem's in this. Stilgar, the Fremen.
Josh Brolin.
Josh Brolin's great,
there's a lot of man in this film, isn't there, with Brolin and Momoa and Batista. I mean, there's a lot of testosterone flying around.
It's dripping off the screen, which sounds disgusting, but I assure you it isn't.
Well, it is the case in the case of the Baron, played by Stellan Skarsgård, who is at one point wallowing in a disgusting black bath and in another point quivering like a blubbering mass on a ceiling. Very disquieting and horrible. Quite excellent.
Yeah. I could honestly talk about this film for like hours.
Well, we can't.
In detail about everything, but sadly we can't. But
we can't because we do have others.
I would just urge everyone to go and see it. To be honest, I think it's the film of the year. I'd be surprised if anything tops this in my eyes. And just that from a purely selfish standpoint, I desperately want to see part two. So everyone needs to go.
Please go out so you can make Jordan's dreams come true. So yes, if you could make Jordan's dreams come true, you can go and see Dune at the cinema from Friday. Go see it, feast your eyes. It's going to be an amazing experience. Okay, shall we stick with Chalamet then, seeing as we started with him, with this?
It began as a holiday. Eager to escape a bright future on the Great Plains, Arthur Howitzer Jr. transformed the series of travelogue columns into the French Dispatch, a factual weekly report on the subjects of world politics, the arts, high and low, and diverse stories of human interest.
You don't think it's almost too seedy this time?
No, I don't.
For decent people.
It's supposed to be charming.
He assembled a team of the best expatriate journalists of his time. Berenson, Sazerac, Kremenz, Roebuck Wright. These were his people.
Just try to make it sound like you wrote it that way on purpose.
So this is Wes Anderson's The French Dispatch, which is a newspaper in France. But who's running it and who's writing it, Jordan?
Well, who's running it is Bill Murray, of course, because it's a Wes Anderson film. So you've got our Bill
Murray.
It's
a legality now, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. This is set in a fictional South French town called Ennui-sur-Blaise, in case you don't get the broad joke there. It's actually a sort of supplement for a newspaper in Kansas, which just adds to the quirk of the whole situation. And it's kind of a tribute to the New Yorker magazine, where they have a series of correspondents who are reporting on various events around France and the continent. So it's essentially an anthology story with a kind of framing device set in the magazine offices. So the first story is set in this prison where you have Tilda Swinton reporting on a prisoner played by Benicio del Toro, who is a convicted murderer who turns out to be this incredible artist who has an affair with a guard played by Lea Seydoux. In the second chapter, you have Frances McDormand reporting on this kind of student uprising, the student rebellion, which is led once again by Timothy Chalamet. It's a big Timothy Chalamet week. He plays this wild-haired rebel leader called Zeffirelli. And in the third chapter, you have Jeffrey Wright, recently seen in No Time to Die, of course, reporting on a chef for a police constable whose son is kidnapped. Mm-hmm. So it's all very quirky. It's all very Wes. If you've seen any of Wes Anderson's films, you'll basically know what to expect from this. It's exquisite compositions. It's a kind of odd, playful sense of humor. It's a kind of oddly melancholy tone I found to this one.
Yes.
It's kind of about the death of a certain kind of journalism, really. The magazine itself is sort of on the way out, and you get that sense throughout the film. What really stood out to me about this film is it's just so fun. Like, I just had a really good time with this. It's so playful and enjoyable. I'd say because of the sort of anthology structure, there's probably going to be some stories that you enjoy more than others. For me, it started strong and got weaker as it went along, but I did really, really enjoy that first chapter. It didn't hit the heights of something like a Royal Tenenbaums or a Life Aquatic for me, but you can feel Wes Anderson's passion for magazines like the French Dispatch / the New Yorker, for these kind of journalist, reporter, correspondent kind of characters. I had no idea that he would be kind of so interested in this world, and I'm glad that he is, because I can't imagine anyone except Wes Anderson making this kind of story.
Yeah, I mean, it totally is print porn, isn't it? The process of putting a publication together, the research and the sort of distilling of your story into a story, and how many words that takes, and what your process is in delivering that. Some of the reporters just sit around eating biscuits in corridors and reading books until the story strikes them. Some of them are sort of furiously typing away in hotel rooms with a glass of wine. Some of them are in the office with their bike. As much as I'd like to say that's what the Total Film Office is like, it kind of isn't. But I have worked in regional newspapers in my youth, where I think those people were just lifted straight from the Yorkshire Post. I'm talking about you. So that element I really enjoyed. And I loved Tilda Swinton in this. You know, she's totally going to be in the awards race, I would have thought, for her performance as this art critic that is based on a real woman who was this wealthy sort of New York socialite who used to do lectures on art and write occasional columns for newspapers. Just brilliant. But the same as you, Jordan, I found that first story really fantastic and frothy and interesting. And then I got less and less interested as it went down the way. You know, if this sort of Wes Anderson quirkyism is twee to you, oh, this will set your teeth on edge. I mean, it is so quirky, isn't it? It's so very Wes Anderson that just if it's not your thing, yeah, it's just a total make it end film if it's not your thing. So it's sort of divisive, I think. You really have to like that stuff to really get a kick out of it. Otherwise, it could be just annoying.
Yeah, I mean, I really love Wes Anderson's films. I think he's a wonderful filmmaker. And even for me, it was pushing things a bit too far at points. Like in the kind of third segment, you have quite extended animated interludes. And I thought that was an odd choice. So I thought, why are we watching this in animation rather than in live action? That didn't really work for me. And there's certain elements throughout, but it felt like with this, he was really using his toolkit to the full extent. Perhaps yes. More than he has in any other film, really. Like, it felt like he was using every device, every resource he could to tell the story, which was, you know, if you like Wes Anderson, you're going to get your money's worth out of this. Yeah. Like, it's
You get your animation, you get your little like title cards, you get like people going up and down weird stairs. It opens with a man delivering a glass of wine and various things up the most ridiculous staircase that is just so Wes.
I'd say, as with every Wes Anderson film, it's full of really enjoyable performances. I particularly enjoyed Benicio del Toro in this. He's an absolute psychopath, but he's weirdly endearing, which I was not expecting. Bill Murray, of course, is just an absolute treat. He has like a couple of mantras as the editor of this magazine. One of them is no crying.
No crying in this office, which I think I might get assigned for the total film office. What do we think for when we go back?
Yeah, that was what I was thinking. Like, we need to get one of those for you, Jane.
One of the amazing things about Wes Anderson is the cast that he can get that certain directors throughout history, be it Robert Altman, Woody Allen and his Pete, you know, certain people who they always have like 10, 12 star names. You're like, wow, but he's taken it to a whole new level. Like we talked about that amazing cast in June, but this one absolutely eclipses it. I'm not even going to name all the names, but there's literally about 30 star names in this film.
Even
if they pop up for, 30 seconds, it's a star name. It's just mad.
I mean, like, you've got like Elizabeth Moss and Owen Wilson and
who have like two lines.
Yeah, they're literally in it for about 2 minutes.
Yeah.
It's the power of Wes, isn't it? Like everyone wants to work with him. And he's just such a singular filmmaker. Like no one makes films like him. So I can absolutely see the appeal of wanting to, be one of the dolls in Wes Anderson's dollhouse. Yeah. Like you just look great. Like there's nothing else like it. Like, why wouldn't you want to do that? I would say this again, this is well worth checking out, I would say, especially if you're a fan of Wes, and even if you just want to have a bit of a fun time. Like if June really, really isn't for you, like if you're just not up for...
But you want a Timothy Chalamet film, you get one here, don't you?
Exactly. And I'd say it's the lesser of the Timmy performances this week, but I still enjoyed him. Again, good hair game.
Just a lot of hair.
Incredible hair game.
Yes, yeah. That's two wonderful hair films from Timothy Chalamet. That's The French Dispatch, which is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, time for plain talking. Are we ready for this? This week, we're talking about what is a blonde. Now, it's not a lady with light hair who's tripping around on set. What is it?
I've been pretty good on these plain talkings, if I say so myself. I like to think I'm up with film terminology, but I don't know a lot about a blonde. All I know is that cinema, films are usually lit by red lights and blonde lights. That I think blonde lights maybe came in after, and that's pretty much all I know. I think it's just a standard lighting device on a film set. I mean, is there more to it than that?
Correct. Tick. Well done. Right. You may go on. You've passed your exam on lighting.
Thank you.
It is a big old light that's, one of those ones on a stand, and it's called a blonde. So it's like, bring in the blonde. But not to be confused with, Marilyn Monroe or anyone else.
Yeah.
Okay, shall we move on? It's time for you, Jamie, to wax lyrical and go back to school with this. When you're broken
on the ground. Dear Evan Hansen, he wrote it to you.
His last words, Connor took his own life.
He what? I'm sorry, Connor didn't write this.
No, please. It's this. You will
be found. We didn't think Connor had any friends.
I mean, you really gonna tell these people that the only thing they have left of their son is a letter that you wrote to yourself?
So, you and Connor, tell us something, please.
Right, I started talking and
you couldn't stop.
They didn't want me to stop.
I'm putting together a memorial service. If you wanted to do something.
Connor showed me that I wasn't alone. Nobody is.
So, let that lonely feeling wash away.
So this is Dear Evan Hansen. Jamie, what's it about? Who's Evan Hansen? I mean, I think we can tell that it's about someone called Evan Hansen.
Yes, we can. Evan Hansen is played by Ben Platt, who played him in the stage musical, which won various Tonys, Emmys, Grammys. It won everything, really. And Evan Hansen is a teenager at high school who suffers from social anxiety disorder. Every day, just to G himself up in the morning, he writes himself a letter, which is a therapist has sort of recommended that he do to kind of give himself a kickstart in a day, a little pep talk. So he's written one of these letters. He goes to school. and the letter is stolen off him by the school bully Connor, who is played by Colton Ryan. And Connor takes this letter, sort of mocks it, puts it in his pocket, and then events take a horrible turn to the left when that night Connor commits suicide and the letter is found in his pocket, and his parents, with the mum played by Amy Adams, find this letter in their son's pocket and mistake it for a suicide note penned to Evan. And they kind of think, oh, my son, who was always very lonely, very depressed, very angry, he must have been friends with Evan. It must have been his one friend. So they go to Evan and they sort of want to talk about their son and know more about their son. And out of a desire to comfort the parents and not kind of prick this bubble, Evan lies and he says, yes, we were friends. We were very good friends. And he begins to create a fiction about it, about their friendship. Now, unfortunately, this fiction spirals out of all control when at the funeral, Evan gets up. He does a heartfelt speech, which is obviously all made up, but this heartfelt speech, which goes viral. And suddenly, you know, this whole thing is spreading and this whole discussion about mental health. And Evan has to keep adding and adding to his lies because he's now in too deep and he can't sort of say, I made it all up. So really, that is a plot and it goes from there. Now, I should say it's also a musical. So it's a musical about suicide, depression, and someone doing what in some ways is a horrible thing, you know, spinning this pack of lies, even though he's doing it from a good place.
But it's a musical. So it is a musical. How are we balancing this dark sort of content with songs? And also, we should mention that when this trailer came out, a lot of people had issues with Ben yes. Platt's age. He obviously originated the role on Broadway and is now doing it in this adaptation.
He was 27 when the film was
27 when they made it. And yeah, he's playing a 17-year-old. Well,
the age thing is an issue in that he clearly is not a 17-year-old, and the makeup they apply to him to try and make him look like a 17-year-old and the kind of frizzy hair they give him all look a bit ridiculous. So that definitely undercuts the film somewhat, and you can see why people had an issue with it. If you can get past that, and I kind of did, because I think this has always been a problem in cinema, you know, 25-year-olds playing teenagers. You go back to something like Grease with Ryan O'Hai, and they're all in their 30s just about. I mean, you know, it's just ridiculous. So, but if you can get past that, I think this is actually an okay adaptation. I mean, some people have really gone for it. They've got the knives out and they've had big issues with it. And I think that's a little bit unfair. I think it's a little bit misguided in places, but it always comes from the heart. It means well. I think Ben Platt he's great in the role, you know, if you can get past the age thing, that he won a Tony, a Grammy and an Emmy for it. We know him from Pitch Perfect as well. He's got a wonderful voice, you know. And
he was singing on Strictly the other week.
Yep, all there. And I think the songs are really good. I mean, they're by Benj Parsek and Justin Poole, who did La La Land and The Greatest Showman. And there's three or four songs particularly in this musical that are really great. The problem is more in how they're put across, that it's a bit schizophrenic, that some of it, you know, some of it is quite stylized and you have a few big numbers in the canteen with everyone dancing, you know, hundreds of people. And then other ones, which I think work better, they really, really downplay it. Like there's one song where Evan is just sat on the sofa with his mum, played by Julianne Moore, kind of pouring out his heart, and the camera just frames the two of them, and it's just very, very downplayed, this song. And I think it's really like effective, really emotional, but it does kind of, you know, lean left and lean right. So it's a bit confusing in that way. But overall, you know, I enjoyed it. I think people have gone wildly overboard getting a nice out for it. I think, like I said, it comes from a good place. It's got great cast in it. Like, also, we haven't mentioned that playing Connor's sister, Zoe, is Caitlin Dever, who we, of course, know from Booksmart and Unbelievable, which was a fantastic show on television. And she brings, you know, real sort of gravitas to it as well. So, yeah, you know, I don't quite get the hatred for it, but I maybe wouldn't go as far as saying you have to come out and see this film now. It's wonderful. You know, I just think it's a solid 3-star movie.
It's not for me.
No. I don't think it won't be for a lot of people. I mean, it's directed by Stephen Chbosky, who did Perks of Being a Wallflower,
and which I didn't like.
Yeah, I didn't mind it, but again, it's almost what you imagine him doing. It's got that sort of slight quirkiness to it, and it doesn't always work, but some of it really does work. And like I said, the cast, when you've got Julianne Moore, Amy Adams and Caitlin Dever in a film, I mean, you know, that's a very strong support cast in a week of strong support cast.
Okay, so if Evan Hansen is your thing, sing and dance your way to the cinema this Friday. Right, time for an alternative line reading. Are you ready for this? I think I'll do this, try and do this in the style of Tilda Swinton doing an art debate in Wes Anderson's The French Dispatch. We rip out so much of ourselves to be cured of things faster than we should, that we go bankrupt by the age of 30 and have less to offer each time we start to someone new. But to make yourself feel nothing so as to feel anything, what a waste. That was my effort. Do you know what that's from?
I will say that was an exceptional impression of Tilda in The French Dispatch. Like, if people haven't seen the film yet, you're going to be blown away.
I have no idea what film that's from. I've got
the faintest
tingling of bells that, you know, it moves something within me, but I can't place it.
Okay, so for your clue, it's a film that by somebody who has featured in two of the films we've discussed already.
Chalamet.
Yeah, it's got to be a Timmy film, right?
Call Me By Your Name.
Yes, it is. It's that wonderful speech by Michael Stuhlbarg where he... talks to Elio on the sofa and assures him that having heartache as a teenager is actually a good thing. And it sounds like this.
We rip out so much of ourselves to be cured of things faster that we go bankrupt by the age of 30 and have less to offer each time we start with someone new. But to make yourself feel nothing so as not to feel anything, what a waste.
That is just ultimate dad goals, that speech, isn't it?
Still right up there.
Interesting that we've mentioned this, though, because Oscar Isaac in June actually reminded me of Stuhlbarg in Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah.
He's just such a good dad.
He's a great dad.
Jordan, you're just trying to bring it back to June, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're not satisfied. You're not satisfied that you talked for 20 minutes about June. It's like, come on.
It wasn't enough.
He was extremely good. And he has really good beard game, like Michael Stuhlbarg does in that film as well. So, you know, dads with beards that have great chats with boys on film. That's what we're celebrating this week. Okay, shall we move on to something completely different then? And when I say completely different, I mean it. It's time to get beastly with this.
Anybody here? Cryptids. What is this place?
The Crypto Zoo is a sanctuary, a place for all the unloved animals in the world.
People think of us as imaginary beasts. But most mythological beings are simply extremely rare beings.
Why would I get involved in the black market?
For the money.
These animals are strong weapons.
I dedicated my life to keeping cryptids safe.
This is Crypto Zoo, which I saw at Sundance with Jordan. You can set this up, Jordan, because it wasn't one of my favorites of that festival. Go ahead.
I would say that if you think Wes Anderson is quirky and offbeat, he's practically like a kitchen sink drama compared to the type of film that Crypto Zoo is. So this is an adult animation by director, writer Dash Shaw. He previously made a film called My Entire High School Sinking Into the Sea, which you may or may not have seen. I imagine most people haven't. This is getting the widest release of his career. It's set in a world of cryptids, of mythical creatures, which are currently being housed in a crypto zoo. These mythical creatures are sort of captured by crypto zookeepers, led by Lauren Gray, who is played by Lake Bell. At the start of the film, two characters, one played by Michael Cera, kind of have a hippie-like encounter in the woods and stumble across the crypto zoo. And their encounter with a unicorn really sort of sets up the tone for this film. It is not a pleasant encounter. It is a very violent and upsetting encounter. And the story from there kind of takes on a almost globe-trotting adventure, Indiana Jones-style quest structure where Lauren is searching for this one mythical creature called a Baku, which is a kind of miniature elephant type creature who can eat dreams. And the American government have decided that this Baku would be the perfect weapon for destroying the dreams of the kind of 70s counterculture movement. So yeah, it's set in the 70s. This is something I forgot to add. It's a very, very, very weird film. And the animation is unlike probably anything you've ever seen before. It's all sort of hand-drawn. It's almost sketch-like.
Scrapbooky, painterly. Isn't it?
Yeah. It was done by Shaw and his painter wife, Jane Samborski. And I found the animation to be quite beautiful, actually, especially when it comes to the cryptids. They're all just wonderfully designed, I thought. They're all kind of ripped from books and from mythology. So a lot of these creatures will be kind of familiar to you. Some of them are like big surprises. There's a kind of giant snake towards the end, which I just thought was actually quite impressive. Like the scale of it is, for an indie animation, I thought they really went all out with this. But I will say it's not for everyone. I think that's definitely worth pointing out. It's a very, very strange, surreal film. All the performances are very much unlike any kind of animated film you've ever seen. They're practically like indie film performances, but in an animated film. So it's all like understated delivery, kind of very down-to-earth dialogue. Like it's not like going to see a Pixar film or a DreamWorks film. It's the exact opposite of that, pretty much. But I really admired what he was trying to do here, and I liked that he used animation to achieve a sort of scale which he could never achieve in live action as a filmmaker. And I think you probably couldn't without a $200 million budget, and no one's ever going to tell this story with that kind of budget level. It just would never happen. So I would say this is again well worth checking out. I very much enjoyed this, but I know that you didn't, Jane.
I didn't, but Jamie, did you?
I loved it.
I have to
say I loved it. I mean, talking of it not being a Pixar-like animation as well, Jordan didn't mention there's also sex scenes in this film and an orgy scene. It is an adult animation, and that isn't why I loved it. I'm not that basic there. It's just like, wee, sex in a cartoon. But no, I thought it was great. The animation, which is very sort of simple 2D drawings with just a tiny bit of computer generation here and there, but it's kind of line scratches, it's kind of watercolors. And I just found it really mesmerizing that it created this kind of kaleidoscopic, psychedelic world. And it just felt so mellow. It had this vibe. I should admit that I watched this film when I was on the tail end of a neurovirus, actually. And and I was kind of in a rather space place at the moment, just sort of lying on my back on the sofa going, oh, I feel so ill. And it just kind of took me to this other world that it was so gentle and so placid, and it's set during the counterculture and everyone's got this sort of hippie vibe as well. And I just really liked it. I think it's got important messages about, you know, intolerance and learning to live with beasts and stuff like that, and being a vegan. That appeals to me as well. And the beasts themselves, these kind of mythical, fantastic beasts. I mean, there's gorgons, there's krakens, there's winged horses, there's whole new creations, you know.
There's one that's got a face in its stomach.
Yes, it has got a face in its stomach and no head. It's just like ends at its shoulders. It's very bizarre. But no, I thought it was great. I really like this film. Like both of you have said, it certainly will not be for everyone. If you know your sort of slightly obscure animation, probably the film it most reminded me of was Fantastic Planet, which was in 1973, which again is this kind of out there left field animation. And yeah, I just thought it's great. I really, really recommend it. And I can't wait to see what Dash Shaw does next.
So, you know, Wes Anderson tests me on the quirkiness-a-thon, and this was right off the scale for me. Like, look at us being weird. Oh, look, we're doing all this, like, lo-fi animation, and everybody's talking like everybody talks like they're so bored. This is such a dull film. And just stupid animals and like
you. Stupid. Just,
I'm sorry. It was absolutely not for me. I found it irritating and annoying and willfully sort of obscure and indie to the point of like, if you don't like this, it's because you're not clever like us. And that was the feeling I got from it. So, you know, I will admit I saw it during a festival, and sometimes you're just at the end of your tether anyway, because you're watching so many things.
Yeah, totally.
That films that you watch that might just ordinarily make you not like them, you absolutely actively hate. But this one, of all the films I watched at Sundance that I dislike, this is the one I remember most for hating the most. So, not for me. Not for me.
It's interesting that Jordan mentioned, you know, well, both of you mentioned much earlier talking about Dune, that Timothée Chalamet's hair is an actor on its own and sort of moves in accordance to his emotions. Because one of the characters in this is a Gorgon. So her hair is obviously always like little snake-like creatures. And the way she passes as human is she kind of has to drug them and like put them all to sleep. So they're under her hat so no one knows. And she looks like a human. But when they come alive, they all sort of writhe around her head, which is fantastic. I love the creatures. I just wanted to sort of adopt them all and take them home and build my own cryptozoo in the garden, a huge one, and have people come and shower them with love. But there you go.
Well, yeah. I think that probably says something more about your gentle and kindness and my meanness.
The only tough thing is, which is something I'm sure Jamie will attest to as well, is that if you are an animal lover, there is quite a bit of sort of violence against these mythological creatures, which is a little bit tough to watch, even in animation.
Because you've got the military sort of want to hunt them down and use them for their own devices. And the scene with a unicorn at the start, which I won't spoil, but, you know, what becomes of a unicorn in that scene, I found it incredibly hard to watch, actually. It was really, really shocking and disturbing.
You shouldn't watch The Last Duel, then, for the horsey deaths.
Oh, God.
Really sad.
There's a lot of historic horse murder in The Last Duel. Okay, so that is Cryptozoo, which is out in cinemas on Friday. I suggest you go drunk. Maybe that'll help. Okay.
Or with the norovirus. No.
Yes.
No. Don't do that. Don't do that.
Don't spread the norovirus in a cinema. That would be terrible. Okay. So just before we go, we should mention our new issue is on sale now with Ghostbusters Afterlife on the cover. And we have time for a reader's question, which is, what is the best movie involving a swimming pool? Jordan.
Well, I know what Jamie's answer is going to be, which I'm not going to steal, which because, of course, it's going to be Swimming with Men, Jamie's favourite film for the last 5 years.
What? Listeners, he is making this up. This is appalling.
We all know how much you love Swimming with Men, Jamie.
No, I didn't love Swimming with Men, did I, Jordan? Let's be honest. I thought it was passable at best, but go on.
My serious answer to this is the ending of Let the Right One In. So fair spoiler warning if you haven't seen that film, but that film ends with an incredible scene in the swimming pool. It's the climax of the entire relationship between the young boy and the young vampire. I just remember just feeling just unbelievably tense in that scene because there's the whole thing about how he's afraid of water and he's sort of forced to keep his head under the water by the kind of bullies at his school. And then all the action takes place
above
the water as you're seeing what's happening below. And it's just,
it's bloody good, isn't it?
Great. Exactly. That's a great choice. It's funny, actually, because I very nearly went for a horror film as well, that I nearly went with It Follows, which, of course, also ends in a swimming pool with all sorts of carnage
as well,
unleashed. But what I'm actually going to go with has not one swimming pool, but multiple swimming pools. And it is called The Swimmer,
which is
a Burt Lancaster film in 1968, where he's at a neighborhood party and he goes for a swim in the pool. And then he hits upon this idea that he would get home by swimming his way home, that he would jump from backyard to backyard and swim through everyone's pools in this very sort of salubrious suburbs. So he sets off on this journey, and it's this like epic hero's journey that as he goes on, things begin to change. The weather darkens, the pools get dirtier, and it becomes this kind of big metaphor for life and the crap we go through and various other things. And it's a very weird, strange, odd film, but quite brilliant. And Burt Lancaster, possibly his best role. So if you haven't seen it, please check that out.
He's in The Sweet Smell of Success. He's great in that.
Okay, I change it. Possibly his second best role.
Thank you.
Yeah, Sweet Smell of Success. He is so good in that.
And that sort of reminds me of The Graduate, which has a great swimming pool scene where Benjamin is sitting at the bottom in his scuba gear, just trying to escape his parents and that man that wants to talk about plastics. But my favourite probably is A Bigger Splash. I love the pool in that film. It's a pool that represents holidays and sunshine and wonder and everything else, but it also represents this appalling incident that happens in the middle of the film and the horror that comes with that and the sort of the things that people hide. So I love that one as well. Cool. All right. So if you have any great movies involving swimming pools you want to share with us, do so on Twitter or Instagram. But for now, I think it's time to bid our fond farewell and say goodbye. So say goodbye, Jamie.
Goodbye.
Say goodbye, Jordan.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me. Bye.
He's pounding down, loaded up and trucking. Are we gonna do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm eastbound, just like old Bandit Run. Keep your foot hard on the pedal, son, never mind them brakes. Let it all hang out, cause we got a run to make. The boys are thirsty in Atlanta, and there's beer in Texarkana, and we'll bring it back no matter what it takes. Eastbound and down, loaded up and trucking. Are we gonna do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm eastbound, just watch old Bandit Run.